No, so we're not having a third song today because over the past 10 lectures I've given on the Gospel of John, I've been preoccupied to a large extent with the first sign, as we all know. But that's now 10 lectures. This is now the 11th lecture on the first sign, and which of course is John turning, Yeshua turning water into wine. And
did this arrival of apocalypse?
Well, I don't want it to. So, and this is why we've cut out the song today, because what I'm doing is, as you know, is analysing John's signs, talking about the signs and their implications and ramifications. Okay. And especially in relation to the Second Temple period and to Judaism and to the Sinai covenant. So what I've decided to do, I just thought, no, I'm going to bring this to the first sign to a screeching halt by combining two lectures today into one. And that's not going to be any small feat. And because then I'll be able to move on to the second sign, and we'll talk about that, which won't be as complicated and as drawn out as this one has been. But what I've tried to do in the lectures on the first sign is restore, as it were, the historic Yeshua. All right? Emphasizing the historicity of Yeshua. And I'll go into that in a second. But if I keep going at the pace that I'm going, I'll be on the fourth or the fifth sign, and the Antichrist will be here, and he'll be here for 42 months, and I'm not allowed to talk about anything during that period of time. So I just don't want to be caught in that situation. Yeah.
It's like waiting for your favourite series to come.
Well, it's almost like our Blue Hills, you know.
Yeah. Episode 593 of Blue Hills.
But
Dr. Mac and all of them roll together.
Dr. Mac, yeah.
Ask me Dr. Mac.
Yeah. My mother used to watch, listen to that religiously, and Portia Faces Life. A true story. Taken from the heart of every woman that had ever dared to love completely. I know it by heart, because I had to listen to it as a child before I went to school. All right, we're into the Gospel of John. Is this recording? I'll just double check.
Yeah. Oops. Red lights on.
The red lights on. The red light district. All right, so this is the Gospel of John, Lecture 11. First sign, water into wine. Cursing of the fig tree. And Yeshua said, you might want to look this up in Matthew 10:34. He said a lot of things, but in this instance he said, "Think not that I am come to cast peace upon earth. I have not come to cast peace, but a sword." Now bear in mind the historicity of the Yeshua that I am presenting in this series of lectures. You'll notice up here too on the whiteboard a quote from the Talmud, taken from Classics of Judaism, 11 Great Books of Jewish Wisdom in a Single File, 2012, Volume 7. "For 7 years did the nations of the world cultivate their vineyards with no other manure than the blood of Israel." You think about that as a statement of fact, and it's horrifying. It's horrifying. Now, what I want you to do, and bear with me in this lecture, because as I said, I'm combining the two lectures into one. So I want you to turn with me to 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 16. Because the Apostle Paul was of the opinion in his day and age that it was no longer vital to know the historical Yeshua, the Nazarene King of the Jews. Rather, God had revealed to the Apostle Paul's insight that Yeshua had transcended the limits of his human disposition and had become the cosmic Christ.
2 Corinthians
chapter 5, verse 16. And I hope I've got the right reference. Yes. He says, "From now on, we recognize no one according to the flesh. I stopped when I was reading that the other night, and I thought to myself, isn't it interesting how we allow, even now, in the 21st century, we believers allow ourselves to be dominated by a local alderman, the local police, the local school teacher, if you're looking for a job, the person that you're going to see to give a resume to. We are apprehensive. Paul says, from now on we recognize no one according to the flesh. And why is that? Because we are in the Messiah. We are in Yeshua. We are the ones who can make decisions relative to our life by praying ahead of time and asking God, number one, to condition the people that we're going to be dealing with, create in them an acceptance of who we are, where we are, and what we are, and then get them to accede their will to us. We have the right to do that. And Paul says, we recognize no one according to the flesh. Even though we have known the Messiah according to the flesh, yet now we know him in this way no longer. What a statement. What a statement. Therefore, he says, therefore, if anyone is in the Messiah, now please, here's my point, and here's Paul's point, he is a new creature. The old things have passed away. Behold, new things have come. Now we might say, well, it hasn't. 2,000 years later, it hasn't happened. Yes, it has. Yes, it has. Because we, and you know what? As far as the IMCF and the members of it are concerned, I can't speak for anyone else, but I know that Isaiah tells us that we are made in the image of God, and therefore we can actually bring about our future in a positive way. God says, as I have thought, it'll come to pass. As I have purposed with intention, shall it reveal itself. That's us. We can do whatever we want to do within the will of God and bring it about, to activate it. And Paul says, we are a new creature. We're not the old man.
Yeah. We're new. Things have passed away, behold, all things have become new.
They've become new in ourselves. Now, Amos was talking in the Parsha about this very concept. The indwelling of Yahweh within us. And therefore, if Yahweh is in us, he demands expression. And when we turn around and do not allow that self-expression in a revelatory way, we are denying the existence of God in his creative intent for us. And if we do, if we are seeing things in the flesh like that, we need to repent. We need to have our heart circumcised. Oh my, I've been in this ministry and work now since 1981, or even before that. But there are times when I've got to stop and I've got to get that knife and I've got to put it in and I've got to drag it around because I see human nature staring me in the face. And I don't like it. But here we are, 2,000 years later. And it is absolutely necessary, in my view, to restore the human Yeshua. You know, what Paul said was correct, but I think 2,000 years later we have to restore him. We've forgotten him altogether. We need a better perspective of the reality of the one, the Logos, who became a flesh and blood human being and thus can identify with each of us. Mm. Amos talked about that today. Not in those words, but very similar words. And, you know, that creator who is Yeshua as a human being is the one who, as true anthropos, true man, capital N, universal man, capital N, he's the one who looks in, sees our human nature, sees our deficiencies, and identifies with our sinful nature. Not that he had a sinful nature, but he understood the impulses of the flesh. If he didn't, he can't identify with us. That's right. But today, we have become almost totally dislocated from Yeshua as a human being. He's become the Christ of faith, and he is the Christ of faith. Don't misunderstand me on that. That's absolutely true. But we have dislocated ourselves from the one who became universal man.
That is because people, more and more, and we see it very much in this age, that I has become the big word. I and me. You listen to people's conversations or phone calls or something, and all you hear is blah blah blah.
This is the I society. iPhones.
And so they've even as Christians have got themselves hooked into this, and instead of taking up your cross daily to follow him, you're following the I trend.
Of course we are. I mean, there it is up here on the whiteboard. I, in personal pronoun I, is numero uno. Okay?
It's nothing.
It's number one. It's number one. But if you have a look at the small I, even the small I, it's when we get into conversation, it becomes an exclamation mark if it's turned upside down. So, you know, we are gods.
Yeah.
And we forget it.
And, you know, we...
The great eye has taken over.
The great eye has taken over. Yeah. And what do they have on top of the pyramid? The Illuminus? Well, the great eye. You know, it's... Hello. So, we are divorced from Yeshua. Too much so. And yet he is our representative man because he understands our nature. And he is our substitute because he's taken our place, deserving of all the punishment on himself that should have been ours. So it's high time to restore the real Yeshua. And he happens to be, according to the Gospel of John, our Messianic King, Nazarene Lord, and Emperor. And this is what John is conveying all the way through his Gospel. He's showing a series of signs that Yeshua did in the form of miracles so that early believers can be encouraged by that, and also his priestly colleagues can identify with the one who was accepted finally by even Caiaphas, the high priest. So, without doubt, our knowledge of the period in which our Lord Yeshua walked the earth and the messianic movement of Yeshua flowered, that whole period of time, in the words of Rupert Furneaux, in a very critical book of Christianity called The Empty Tomb, he wrote that that period depicted for us by Josephus, that is the period in which Yeshua found himself, who blames the visionary hopes of his fanatical people for the terrible disaster that befell them, he says that disaster brewed for 60 years before the smouldering hatred of the Jews for their Roman rulers burst into flame. It was a period marked by the acclamation of a number of would-be messiahs, each of whom fanned the flames of revolt. So Rupert Furneaux, as a historian, understands that the Zealots came not a few years before the war with Rome, but it came way back when Yeshua was first born. It started, and then it became a political organization at the time of the Roman internationalizing of the city of Jerusalem. When Rome did that in 6 CE, the Zealot Revolution began full on. And it simmered, he says, for 60 smoldering years, which is my whole thesis about the water into wine. He says, the salient fact for our consideration is the occupation of the Holy Land by the Romans, to the Jews an appalling sacrilege. They refused to accept it, and they believed fervently that the coming of the long-awaited Messiah was imminent. The last days were at hand, the final age could be expected at any moment. These visionary hopes were fed by a stream of apocalyptic literature, chiefly Galilean in origin, and Galilee was the centre of nationalistic resistance to Roman rule. And of course Yeshua came from Galilee. This was the atmosphere in which Yeshua, or he says Jesus, and his disciples lived. Now, it's rather interesting. If you want to find out whether Yeshua or Jesus actually lived, you've only got to go to Google. Put in the question, did Jesus actually live? And you will get 19 million mixed pro and con results. 19 million. Everyone's got an opinion. Everyone's got an opinion. And yet, at the conclusion of the 19th century, it was the German rationalists and critics of the Bible who spearheaded the notion that Jesus was a mythological figure. figure, who never in fact existed. And this today, in the 21st century, is still the opinion of many celebrated and very brilliant biblical scholars, even like and historians like Robert Eisenman, a good example. But I find it intriguing that the charge that Yeshua was a pious myth, the charge that Yeshua was a pious myth invented by the Constantinian Church never entered the early minds of the original opponents of Christianity. You never once find any of them turning around saying, he never existed. What are you talking about? It's a myth. They never once surface with that objection.
The Talmud itself even gives claim to his royal line from David.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But these opponents of Christianity had access to reams of hardcore evidence from Caesar's imperial libraries, including procurata surveillance reports of Yeshua and his disciples, that the founder of the school, which evolved rapidly into the messianic movement of the Second Temple period as part of the fourth philosophy of the Zealot insurgency and underground resistance to the Roman beast, was crucified as a fomenter of insurrection. You hear me? Who possessed a force of 900 Zealots with whom he attacked the Jerusalem temple and occupied its environs in order to purify its sacred limits. And there is internal evidence in the Gospels that he did so precisely and to his advantage at a simultaneous time of revolt which began when he entered the city on an unbroken ass in fulfillment of an ancient prediction located in the scroll of the prophet Zechariah. And Christians today know absolutely nothing about that event. Nothing. And yet, it is more than hinted at the Synoptic Gospels. And today, I just want to cover a few points before I get into the meaty, nitty-gritty of this combination of lectures. Who can tell me here today what I spoke about last time?
Yeah,
go.
2 weeks ago.
Yep.
The last lecture. The last lecture was on.
I can see everybody listening to this overseas scrambling for their notes. His notes. Yeah.
Yeah, you're close.
Sorry?
Lecture number 9, wasn't it?
No, lecture number 10.
2 weeks ago.
Well, remember that the yes.
The attack on the temple.
Yes.
Yeah.
My word. It was the attack on the temple.
I'll back to the notes.
I mean, look, it.
I remember that.
We all know that the charges brought against Yeshua had to do with the wild acclaim of all the throngs of Jerusalem when they came out crying out, King, right? King, Son of David, free us, right? These were the words that caused Pilate to finally intervene, because it was treason. It was treason. There was only one king, and that was Caesar. And yet here Messiah comes, entering into Jerusalem at a time of crisis, and he has all Jerusalem, it says. That's a lot of people coming down to watch him come in through the gates, riding on an unbroken colt, bucking away, and they all expected the Messiah to welcome himself, if you wish, to invite acclaim by using that approach. And there's something else too that I've talked about last time, and that was the fact that Caesar knew all about Yeshua. He knew all about him from surveillance reports of Pilate. And of course, he had the habit of surrounding himself with well-known political undesirables. So that didn't help the Nazarene's case when he was brought before Pilate. So in other words, as I pointed out in our last lecture, Yeshua's attack on the temple brought upon him the entire negative might of Roman military power. It might seem to some a provocative overstatement and to others a provocative understatement to posture that the Jews were a threat to the peace of the Middle East when Yeshua and his disciples walked the streets of the Galilee and Jerusalem during the Second Temple period. The Robertson is nearly passing out here with that statement. But let me just say this.
That nothing's changed.
Let me just say... Let me just say this.
They still reckon they're a threat.
4 or 5 million Jews, now listen to me, 4 or 5 million Jews lived in Judea and Galilee, Egypt and Mesopotamia, and an equal number were scattered right throughout the Mediterranean Roman world, the Roman Empire. And it has been called the Jewish existence at that time and proclivity toward revolt has been called, quote, a dangerous powder train. And of course, if you're a historian, you know this to be true. You know this to be true. And that dangerous powder train could spark off revolt from Judea all the way around the Mediterranean known world. And from 6 CE onwards, as I've taken pains to explain over the last 10 lectures, more and more Jews joined the Zealots, who were determined, with God on their side, I mean, even that statement, with God on their side, takes you back to the 60s, when I was involved to some extent with a little bit of unrest in Australia, and we used to sing, you know, with God on our side, you know, we used to, okay, because we believed God was on our side. But be that as it may, they wanted God on their side to boot the pagan infidels out of God's holy land and back to the shores of Italy. And you know what? When you look at the situation of the triumphal entry, the cleansing of the temple, Yeshua turns around and he says, if you had the faith of a grain of mustard seed, you would say to this mountain, what mountain? We talk about this to be our personal mountain, our personal problems with our wife, with our family, with our kids, with our neighbours, with our government. That's the mountain. You need to overcome the mountain. Yeshua said the mountain needed to go back to Italy where it came from. Look at the context. The Jews didn't realize that they had the power to kick Rome out of God's holy land if they only repented and accepted Mashiach. It was that simple. It was that simple. But today we've taken that out of its context and apply it to all our... And we can do that too. It's the principle applies. We can, whatever our mountain is in life, we can exercise authority over it. There's no doubt about that. But Yeshua was talking specifically about Rome.
That's
so
interesting. Sorry? That's so interesting.
No. Sorry. You're right. Look, the Zealots were especially active in Galilee, and in the year of Judea's annexation, their founder, Judas the Galilean, proclaimed himself King Messiah. Now you'll find that in Josephus. He led a massive revolt which was quickly crushed, but it went underground. It went underground and it simmered, as Rupert Furneaux admits, for 60 long years before it burst forth again in full revolt. And the Zealots were circumspect in their estimation. They were living in the last days. Now remember the last lecture? I said they expected Emmanuel to come at that time, when they saw a star rise, and that was based on Numbers 24:17, the star of Jacob, and it rose in the heavens, and they associated that with an obscure prophecy in Isaiah chapter 7, verses 7, 8, and 9, which talked about a 65-year period which was never fulfilled back in the days of Isaiah. It was never fulfilled any time in history, and they applied it to themselves, and they believed that 65 years from the birth of the Emmanuel, they would rise up against this great mountain, casting it back to Italy. And of course, all it did was bring about their destruction. And yet, Yeshua figures intimately in the relationship of the zealots and the impending disaster that came upon the Jewish nation. And I believe this is the real reason today that Yeshua is despised by the rabbis, and they've forgotten essentially what sparked it off in the beginning, which was the zealot revolt. That's my assessment of it. But be that as it may, if you turn to John 18 and have a look at verse 2, John 18 and look at verse 2, because it's John who informs us of the fact that when Pilate sent his troops to arrest Yeshua on the Mount of Olives, he dispatched an entire detachment of Romans to seize the Messiah. Now have a look at John 18, verse... No, am I in the right place here? John 18, verse 2, and verse... Was it verse 12?
Verse 2, detachment of soldiers.
John 18, verse 2... Yeah, 2, it was in verse 3, actually. Judas also, who betrayed him, knew the place, for Yeshua oftentimes resorted there with his disciples. Judas then, having received a band of men and officers, notice this, came forth with weapons. And if you look at verse 12, the band and the captain and the officers took Yeshua and bound him away. And the Greek word for band or detachment, as it is in most Bibles, detachment, is the Greek word spiera, spiera, which consisted of 600 hand-picked, battle-hardened soldiers, including 66 cavalry. And you'd think, well, that's a lot of people just to arrest a man of peace. But it could also apply to Roman auxiliaries of between 500 and 1,000 men. So whatever the figure was, we have 500-plus Romans, let alone the temple police and all the others that came, dispatched to arrest one lonely man we are led to believe was a harmless, gentle rabbi who taught religious heresy in a sermon in which he mentioned the beatitude, "Blessed are the cheesemakers." Now, that is an utter nonsense. To send all those men into one area to get one man beggars belief, especially if he was that kind of person. So, if we take into consideration that in verse 12, John specifically mentions a captain or a commander of the troops, this is Chiliarchos, meaning a commander of 1,000 men and one of 6 tribunes attached to a legion. So you're looking at a vast army descending on the Mount of Olives to arrest one itinerant Jewish preacher. And this reveals the vital importance that Tiberius Caesar himself placed on the investigation, surveillance, and arrest of Yeshua. Now, these are facts from which I won't hide. They stare me in the face. Drop down, go over to Matthew, and have a look at Matthew 21. Matthew 21, because Matthew has somewhat to say on the same period of time, and he talks about an elaborate pre-orchestrated arrangement concerning the borrowing of an ass with its colt prior to the venture by the disciples to obtain them. All right? So, when I read this section in relation to the triumphal entry, I have to read between the lines. It's the subtext of what's not actually said that is interesting. Who owned the ass? Doesn't say.
Plenty.
What part of town was the ass to be located? It doesn't say. But clearly it had to be visible for the disciples
to get it.
And they could
even there because he had plenty of money.
He had plenty of money. It could have been Nakdamon. But it had to have been prearranged between the mysterious owner and Yeshua, obviously. Yeah. But there's... What this tells me, all right, is that it is another indication of a personal time frame within which Yeshua worked out his life's program. and he had to do something surreptitiously. When they, look at verse 1. When they drew near to Jerusalem and were come to Bethphage, to the Mount of Olives, then sent Yeshua two disciples, saying to them, go into the village opposite you, and immediately you shall find an ass securely tied and a colt with her. Loose them and bring them to me. And if anyone questions you, you shall say, the Lord has need of them. Immediately he will send them. So he obviously knew that they were coming. All this was done that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the prophet, saying, tell you, the daughter of Zion, behold, your king comes to you, meek, and sitting upon an ass, with a colt, the foal of an ass. And the disciples went, and did as Yeshua commanded them, and brought the ass and the colt, and put on them their outer garments, and they set him thereon. And a very great multitude spread their garments in the way. Others cut down branches from the trees and spread them in the road. And multitudes went before, and that followed, crying out continuously, saying, Hosanna to the Son of David. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Hosanna in the highest. And when he was come to Jerusalem, all the city was moved, saying, who is this? And the multitude said, this is Yeshua the prophet, the Nazarene from Galilee. And Yeshua went into the temple of God, cast out all of them that sold and bought in the temple. He overthrew the tables of the money changers and the seats of them that sold doves and shouted at them, it is written, my house shall be called a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves. This was nothing less than an armed assault on the temple. And I have shown plainly in previous lectures that Yeshua prevented the continuation of the sacrificial system at that time. He permitted no one to enter or to leave with vessels. The vessels represented all the offering factors that went along with the sacrificial system. And if he prevented the very vessels involved in the sacrificial system from going in and out of the temple, guess what? He prevented the sacrificial system as well. So why did the temple police feel powerless to intervene? The answer, to my mind, is so obvious it leaps in the pages of history with a wild shout. Because the zealots at that time were also attacking the adjoining Roman fortress, Antonia, or Antonia, which was built flush against the wall of the temple itself. So the Romans were preoccupied with fighting with their military power against a rebel called Yeshua Barabbas. Yeshua Barabbas. And Mark speaks of a recent insurrection at the same period of time and mentions that it failed. Interesting. This is why there is no mention of a Roman intervention in the riot that followed the triumphal entry of Yeshua and the storming of the temple. They were already up against the forces unleashed by the zealot Yeshua Barabbas. Now you'll notice up here on the whiteboard, I've got down the bottom here the importance of Slavonic text of Josephus. Okay. Now, the reason I'm taking the time to read this text is because we've all been exposed in our modern English translations of the highly corrupted and controversial version of Josephus' mention of Yeshua, or Jesus, if you wish, in his Antiquities of the Jews. But if you've got Josephus, this is what he seems to say. About this time there lived Jesus, a wise man, if indeed one ought to call him a man. For he was one who performed surprising deeds and was a teacher of such people as accept the truth gladly. He won over many Jews and many of the Greeks. He was the Messiah. And when, upon the accusation of the principal men among us, Pilate had condemned him to crucifixion, those who had first come to love him did not cease. He appeared to them, spending a third day restored to life, for the prophets of God had foretold these things and a thousand other marvels about him. And the tribe of Christians, so called after him, has still to this day not disappeared. Now that's the quote from Josephus. If you are a student of Josephus, you will have difficulty believing that he wrote that. And I don't doubt that that is what is in your mind. It's known in academic circles as the Testimonium Flavianum. And despite the truculent insistence of Christian apologists to its authenticity, it remains a forgery of the worst kind. I say the worst kind because what the Christians wanted to do was to take someone who had authority, someone who was a historian, someone who was Jewish, and make him believe in the Messiah. So a pious hand around the time of Eusebius added that entire paragraph or interpolated it. All right? Now, when you look up Origen, now Origen was a church father. He lived 182 to 254. If you look at his commentary on Matthew, he quotes Josephus, or mentions Josephus, in a section in which he speaks of James, the Lord's brother. And this is what he says. Origen says, "To so great a reputation among the people for righteousness did James rise, that Flavius Josephus, who wrote the Antiquities of the Jews in 20 books, when wishing to exhibit the case why the people suffered so great misfortunes, that even the temple was razed to the ground, said that these things happened to them in accordance with the wrath of God, in consequence of things which they had dared to do against James, the brother of Jesus, who was called Christ." And he does say that, Josephus does say that. And then Origen says, "And the wonderful thing is that though he did not accept Jesus as Christ," hello, knock knock. Did you notice this? Remember when Origen lived, between 182 and 254. He says, "Though he did not accept Jesus as Christ, yet he gave testimony that the righteousness of James was so great," and he says that the people thought that they had suffered these things because of James. Now, Origen's claim that Josephus did not acknowledge Jesus as the Messiah is again stated in his 47th chapter of his first book in Contra Celsus. Origen, you could say 250 CE, Origen, 250 CE, knows nothing of Josephus' allegiance to Yeshua, but by the time of Eusebius, 350 CE, in that century between Origen and Eusebius, 100 years between them, the spurious passage is there. It's attested. It appears in Antiquities during that century between the two church fathers. It wasn't there originally, and then suddenly it appears around the time of Eusebius. So, all the works of Josephus have been translated into the modern languages, English, French, German. We even have scholarly versions in Arabic and Syriac, and the old Russian, the old Slavonic text. Now, Josephus's rough Greek text of what became the Jewish War, okay, before he actually polished it in Greek, the old Hebrew and or Aramaic translated into Greek, the original, was entitled On the Capture of Jerusalem. It wasn't called the Jewish War, it was called On the Capture of Jerusalem. And this is the very title that appears on the Slavonic manuscripts. So, guess what? If they haven't changed the title to the Jewish War, you get a pretty good indication that what it contains might be authentic. Just might. Even though it could be corrupt here and there, overall, you might get a different view of what Josephus had to say. And indeed, we do. We know there was a Hebrew version of the Jewish War, but that went missing about the 5th century of our era. Okay. Josephus had, remember this, had official access to Roman edicts, annals of the procurators of Judea. He had access to their official reports to Caesar, and referring to that which was occurring in outlying provinces. He had ready access to petitions, proclamations, statutes, and reports of judicial proceedings. And I have no doubt Josephus read Pilate's report on the crucifixion of Yeshua. Now, keeping in mind that all texts of Josephus have been corrupt one way, you know, to one degree or another, listen to what it actually says about Yeshua's two proceedings before Pilate. Two proceedings, because Matthew doesn't say that there were two. Mark doesn't say there were two. Luke and John don't say there were two. And yet here is the Slavonic text, and this is what it says. At that time there appeared a man, if it is permissible to call him a man. Okay, so Josephus in the Greek, inter-English, and the Slavonic text seems to be much the same here. His nature and form were human, but his facial appearance was something more than that of a man. Notwithstanding, his works were divine. He worked miracles wonderful and mighty. Therefore, it is impossible for me to call him a mere man. But again, if I look at the nature which he shared with all, I will not call him an angel. And everything whatsoever he wrought through an invisible power, he wrought by word and command. You know what? That's exactly what John tells us. He didn't touch people in John. He just speaks the word. Some said to him, our first lawgiver is risen from the dead and has performed many healings and arts. While others thought that he was sent directly from God. Howbeit, in many things he disobeyed the law. Now this is Josephus. In many things he disobeyed the law. Yes, he embraced those who were lepers without himself becoming unclean.
Didn't wash his hands.
He didn't wash his hands.
And
he says, and kept not the Sabbath according to our father's customs.
He
did things that didn't go against the commandment, but it went against all the traditional teachings. And in fact, Josephus in this particular version, Slavonic text, says that, kept not the Sabbath according to our father's customs. Yet, on the other hand, he did nothing shameful, nor did he do anything with the aid of hands. But by words alone he provided everything. This is intriguing to me. I'm reading this, I'm going, this is gelling with me. This is gelling with me. Because it's the word that becomes flesh and dwells among us. It is the word we speak and utter forth that brings about what we want. Yeshua says, if you say to this mountain, not if you do this to the mountain, if you say this, if you utter it, if you voice it, nothing doubting, it'll be done, it says. There's a book on the shelf over there, it's called The Secret. You know what? It says the same thing.
You just have to be able to believe it.
Belief is so important. You're quite correct, Laurel. By words alone did he provide everything. And many of the multitude followed after him and hearkened to his teaching. Many souls were in commotion. Yeah. You betcha. Thinking that thereby the Jewish tribes might free themselves from Roman hands. There we are. Now it was his custom in general to sojourn over the city upon the Mount of Olives, and there too he bestowed his healings upon the people. And there in that place assembled unto him of ministers 150, and a multitude of the people. Now when they saw his power, that he accomplished whatever he would by a word, and when they had made known to him their will, that he should enter into the city and cut down the Roman troops and Pilate and rule over us, he disdained us not. Please notice that. What a remarkable comment. He didn't say, away with you, you don't know what you're talking about, don't do this thing. No, he didn't say, stop. What did he do? John tells us, when they tried to make him king, he departed from them. Huh? He just walked away. He disdained us not. He didn't sit there correcting them, he just went away. When thereafter knowledge of it came to the Jewish leaders, they assembled together as a Sanhedrin with the high priest and spoke. We are powerless and too weak to withstand the Romans. Seeing moreover that the bow is bent. Remember Yeshua said to the disciples, have you got a sword? And one of them turned around and he said, I've got two swords. He said, it is enough. Okay, he puts himself in a position where he's identifying with the movement. He puts himself in a position where he's identifying with the zealots. Seeing moreover that the bow is bent, we will go and communicate to Pilate what we have heard, and we shall be clear of trouble, lest he hear it from others, and we will be robbed of our substance, and ourselves slaughtered, and our children scattered. And they went and communicated it to Pilate. And he sent and had many of the multitude slain. These are followers of Yeshua, who are slaughtered. He had that wonder worker brought up. See, wonder worker. Josephus in the Slavonic text is not saying, I believe in Yeshua, I believe in the Christ. He's not. He's saying that wonder worker, after instituting an inquiry concerning him, he pronounced judgment. He is a benefactor, not a malefactor, nor a rebel, nor covetous of kingship. And he let him go, for he had healed his dying wife. Now immediately your head goes into recoil, because you're thinking of the one part, one trial that's mentioned by the gospel writers. He went to his wonted place and did his wonted works, and when more people again assembled around him, he glorified himself through his actions more than all. The teachers of the law were overcome with envy and gave 30 talents to Pilate in order that he should put him to death. So the 30 talents that went to Judas, where did that go? You know it was scattered into the holy place. What did they do with it? Some said, let's buy a field. Some said, let's do this, let's do that. According to this, he took and gave, that 30 talents were given to Pilate in order that he should put him to death. He took it, gave them liberty to execute their will themselves. They laid hands on him and crucified him contrary to the law of their fathers. Now, crucified they didn't, but there's the intimate details of the Jews taking him and doing what Pilate said. You go and you kill him according to your law, which was blasphemy, therefore stoning him to death. So this becomes very intriguing when you take this text and compare it with the gospel account and compare it with the deficiency of what we call the Greek recension. It complies with the gospel accounts but adds further enlightening information that the gospel writers failed to record for one legitimate reason or another. If you look at Mark 11, verse 11, Mark 11, verse 11, after he has his triumphal entry, Yeshua enters into Jerusalem and into the temple. And when he had looked around about upon all things, the eventide had come, and he went out to Bethany with the 12. Now please notice, he doesn't cleanse the temple at that point. This is a few days before he does that. And what's he do? He's surveying the temple. He's having a good look at where people are positioned and what is occurring. So, the following day, he curses a fig tree, the symbol of the political and religious state of the Jewish people. And in due course, it withers and dies. Please notice up on the whiteboard, if you go to Matthew and have a look at the cursing of the fig tree, you will find that the triumphal entry is mentioned first, then the temple is purified, because Yeshua attacks it and cleanses it, and then the fig tree is cursed, and instantly it dies in the sight of the disciples. That's Matthew's account. If you look at Mark's account, there's the triumphal entry, so they both agree that that occurred in its sequence, but then the fig tree is cursed, and the next day the disciples find it dead. That's what it says. And then, point three, the temple is then cleansed and purified. So Mark and Matthew disagree with each other on that. So when we're looking at Josephus, and we see Josephus in the Greek and Josephus in the Russian, slightly different, in a major way different to one another, we shouldn't then turn around and say, throw it all away. We have to sit down and look at it all carefully and balance it all out.
Yeah. I don't know why they didn't have that kind of attitude. Because we have that game today, it's badly called Chinese Whispers.
Oh, yeah.
If you had a band of children in a circle, they would tell somebody something. By the time it gets around to the child sitting on the other side of that first person, it's something completely different.
It is.
Because everybody sees things
their way.
In a different way.
They see it in a different way, in a different manner.
There might be similarities, but the emphasis will be different.
It will be. This is why we've got four Gospels. But Yeshua curses the fig tree, and Israel remains for 2,000 years scattered, persecuted, and it is only in 1948 that Israel is reborn as a state and gains statehood. But it's born into a world of hostility, shocking hostility. to everything and all things Jewish. Now that's going to change. The Bible tells us that right at the very end of the age, just before the Antichrist makes his appearance, Israel's going to be accepted worldwide. You're going to have people coming to the Jews and adopting Jewish habits and so forth, and Jewish traditions and so forth, like it occurred in the Second Temple period and thereafter. So, rather intriguing. I mean, I'd like to believe that the end of the age is coming in 2017. I'd like to believe that, I really would, but I can't see it happening. And I wish it would be the case, but it's not. Too much has yet to be fulfilled. But having said all of that, there is no doubt that while John is unusually silent about that attack on the temple occurring in the last year of Yeshua's ministry, in the last year, he sticks it right at the very beginning of his gospel to make a point. And I keep mentioning that and taking you back to that all the time. But finally, after he has attacked the temple and he's occupied the temple, he then turns around and gives the Jews a sign. He gives them a sign. John chapter 2, verse 18. The Jews confronted him by asking him. Now don't forget, my last lecture I mentioned that the Sadducees had to do two things as members of the Sanhedrin. If they found someone claiming to be the Messiah, number one, they had to denounce him. Number two, ask for a sign to prove his authenticity. They had to do that. And you find Yeshua being hounded all the time by the Sadducees, asking him for a sign and denouncing him as the Messiah. So the Jews confronted him, saying, "What miraculous sign can you show us to prove you have the heavenly authorization to do all this?" Yeshua responded, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up again." Now, you know what? If you were living in that time and you heard Yeshua say that, the first thing you'd think of was this temple. He's just attacked the temple. He's just purified the temple. He's just kicked out all the money exchanges. He's overturned the tables of the dove sellers and all that. And he says, "Destroy this temple." He said, "I'll build it in 3 days. Now, of course, you would think he was talking about the Jerusalem temple. And the Jews responded, "It took 46 years to build the temple, and you're going to raise it up in 3 days. But the temple he had spoken of was his body. Therefore, when he was raised from the dead, his students remembered what he had said, and they trusted in the Tanakh and in what Yeshua had said." So he finally gives them the admission, "I am the Messiah." That's what he's saying. And of course, the raising of Lazarus from the dead, and we will get there eventually to the seventh sign, finally convinced Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin that he was in fact the Messiah, and then they worked with him to fulfill his messianic destiny. No doubt about that. Now we'll get to that in due time. Mind you, that's not to deny that some of the Sanhedrin wanted Yeshua dead then, and certainly some of them plotted to kill Lazarus a second time. They wanted him dead a second time, and that's mentioned also, as I mentioned in the last lecture. So we have to understand that not all at that time were in favour of Yeshua, but the majority were, and frankly, near the very end of his life, we have to remember there were two Sanhedrin members who went to help Yeshua in his death and burial, and that was Nathanael Ben-Gurion, or Nicodemus, and the other was Joseph of Ramatayim. So, I stated in the last lecture, there can be absolutely no doubt in our minds that Yeshua deliberately plotted all his actions, which culminated in the tragic events of his final week and drew simultaneously thousands of innocent people along in his wake. He did so in order to fulfill the messianic prophecies. My question is, how far do we think Yeshua would go in bringing about the prophetic destiny of his messiahship? I believe, I don't know about you lot, but I believe that Yeshua would stop at nothing.
Got himself crucified, didn't
he? That's right. But in his wake, he took thousands of people to their deaths. Because according to the Slavonic Josephus, all those on the Mount of Olives that were originally his disciples were slaughtered. And there is a hint of it in the Gospels. And that hint happens to be You know the Tower of Siloam that collapsed and fell and all those people died, you know? And remember he said to all those people that died when Pilate mingled their blood with their sacrifices? Yeah. He says, unless you repent, you'll likewise perish. It's rather intriguing.
It is amazing that if we're to believe that his ministry was only 3 years, it's a lot to have accomplished.
Well, according to the synoptic gospel writers, it was only 1 year. So if you look at John's 3 years, it's, and all that he did, you wonder how he did it. Miriam, can you just check on him, see if he's okay?
He hasn't gone out to the car, has he? I think he'll be out with the aircon on.
But as a consequence of this disturbance that Yeshua created in Jerusalem, two zealots, because they're called Lestai, and Lestai meant revolutionary or insurrectionist, two zealot Lestai were crucified alongside Yeshua. No matter whether we accept what I say or disagree with what I say, the fact is two Lestai were crucified with this man. They were nailed with him on the one tree, as John says, and above the important one was the charge of treason. And the titulus displayed that for all the world to see that Yeshua was the Nazarene king of the Jews. And that's what Pilate was saying, treason. But those who were crucified with him, remember what they said? One says, remember me when you come into your kingdom. So he had been exposed to the teaching of Yeshua. But don't forget, he's a Lestai, he's a zealot. And the other one reviles Yeshua with bitterness and rage and spits at him, save yourself and us. Remember that? Save yourself and us. And he was a Lestai. He was a revolutionary. And it's my contention that a messianic outburst occurred resulting from Yeshua's triumphal entry into the city of Jerusalem, filled with tens of thousands of festival pilgrims, which culminated in scenes of violence in which men were slain and taken prisoner by Pilate. And Pontius Pilate's seat of government was in Caesarea. He never went to Jerusalem until the festival periods. He would march his troops, history tells us this, he would march his troops from Caesarea, his shock troops, to strengthen his military detail that was stationed in the Roman fortress Antonia. And he did so at the festival times because it was more likely that an uprising of Jews would occur during that period of time, that fanaticism during such seasons would be rife. And I think Yeshua had the foresight to realise what he was accomplishing, for he worked his life out to a timetable of events perfectly. He never left anything to chance. Every I was dotted, every T was crossed. That meant innocent people were swept along in his wake. And I have no doubt of that. And what I'm trying to do in these lectures is focus our attention on his humanity, on him as a human being. And the disturbance, as he came into Jerusalem and he attacked the temple, the disturbance was a signal for the uprising of the zealots attacking the fortress at the time Yeshua attacked the temple. And it is Socinus Heraclius who spoke of the tradition still in circulation in his day that 900 zealots accompanied Yeshua in the attack on the temple. I've demonstrated aptly that 1,000 temple police couldn't stop Yeshua. If he was one man, they would have grabbed him. And yet he was in charge of the temple days later, still in charge of it, and people were coming to hear his words. Astonishing. No one could stand against him. So the zealots launched their assault on the Roman garrison concurrently with the attack on the temple. Obviously. And Mark mentions a number of insurrectionists, but also a notable murderer named Barabbas. And he says in Mark 15 and verse 7, I want you to look at this. Mark 15 and verse 7, it says, Barabbas was in prison with the rebels. Notice the word Lestai here. Barabbas was in prison with the rebels, the Lestai, who had committed murder during the insurrection. And then the gospel writer goes on to fail to mention what the insurrection was all about. And you wonder, well, why didn't he tell us what that was all about? Well, it was common knowledge. And here is another reason why I believe Mark was the earliest gospel written. And of course, it could be added to all the Bible critics, Germans particularly, who are of the consensus opinion that Mark wrote his gospel very early in the piece. But here again would be another proof that that was the case. But incidentally, a number of early New Testament gospel codices speak of Barabbas as Jesus Barabbas, or Yeshua Barabbas. And this is attested to by Origen, who found this reading in a very early manuscript of Matthew's gospel. So here you have a reality being shown to us, because along with any positive event comes a negative in our life. And I'm sure we've all experienced this to one degree or another. Time for rejoicing, and so while we're rejoicing, over here there's a negative to pull us down and take away the blessing. Over here there is the positive, over here there is the negative. And it never fails. It never fails. I remember, I'll just give a private thing here, when the Robertson and I would go out and have a wonderful night out, we hadn't been out for months, we'd go out, and we'd come home high on energy, and find out that the kids had ruined something. We would walk in the door, and everyone was nice and quiet and circumspect, and you'd think, what happened? What's gone wrong? And then after a while, sorry, Mum, we broke your lamp. Or, sorry, Dad, okay. A positive and a negative, always. And here you have, that tells us that no Christian should expect a life without trials and upsetting circumstances, or everything's got to be tidy and in its place. It doesn't work like that. Life's a mess, and we have to work our way through it. All right. Having said that, because half the messes, but having said that, here is Yeshua, the Son of the Father, and alongside of him, Pilate brings forth Yeshua Barabbas. So here you, and that means, Barabbas means Son of the Father. So here you've got the positive Yeshua, Son of the Father. Over here you've got Yeshua, Son of the Father, who's a Lestai. And he says, who do you want? Who do you want me to give to you? And they call out, Barabbas, Barabbas, but I'm not the other one. And don't forget, in the Yom Kippur ceremony, there were two goats brought before the high priest, and they were identical. They had to be absolutely identical. And one was to be killed, and after the sins of the people were placed upon his head, had to be led away to sacrifice, because God takes responsibility for our sins. He really does. But the other goat represented Azazel, which is Hasatan. And he had the Israelites' sins placed on him too, and was led away into the wilderness. And of course, that particular goat represented the accountability that Satan ultimately one day will have to face and accept. So on the one hand, you've got the positive, God takes responsibility. On the other hand, you've got the negative, Hasatan has to take accountability. It was Hasatan that worked in the Garden of Eden to destroy Adam and Eve. And don't worry, don't think twice, he will work in our life to destroy us. He will. He will work in our nature. He will work in our character. He will work in our situation. He will work in our circumstances to destroy us.
And he knows each individual's weaknesses.
And he does.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's what he'll work on.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if we don't know our weaknesses, how on earth can we work out what his strategies will be? Mm. It's a very valid point, Laura. Thank you. Now, so today we have people who are desperate to say that Yeshua never ever lived. Jesus never lived. Few realize that Caesar, Tiberius Caesar, he believed he lived, and he wanted to make him a god. He wanted to make him a god. And the Emperor of Rome accepted his status. But people don't know about it today because people are not taught. Church teaching is void about it, and people themselves are too lazy to get the history books out and look things up. They go to churches on Sunday and they get swallowed up with fairy tales and and the romance of sheer idiocy. You know, and I just shrugged my shoulders thinking, you know, well, you know, you people, you've only got yourself to blame. And the Jews know nothing about these events, and this particular event of Tiberius Caesar recognizing Yeshua, because Jewish people are not taught the truth by their rabbis. Their rabbis are who are more interested in the Talmud and the Mishnah and the Gemara rather than and the writings of the sages rather than the scripture itself. They scrupulate over Talmudic passages and sometimes moronic ramblings of their rabbinic ancestral sages, and Gentiles grab hold of some of the stuff that some of these sages have to say, and small wonder there's negative reaction to the Jews. And you sort of go, well, you know, you guys, if you're going to write that, if you're going to say that, and a Gentile's going to grab hold of it and run with it, then you're to blame.
Bring it on yourself.
You're bringing it on yourself. Not everything, but you bring that on yourself, for sure. So, Tertullian tells us all about Tiberius Caesar recognizing the divinity of Yeshua. You will find it in Tertullian's Apology, chapter 5, in the Ante-Nicene Fathers. And he says, to say a word about the origin of laws of the kind to which we now refer, there was an old decree that no god should be consecrated by the emperor till first approved by the Senate. That's the Roman Senate. Marcus Aemilius had experience of this in reference to his god Albinus. And this too makes our case, he's talking about the Christian argument, that among you Romans, divinity is allotted at the judgment of human beings. Unless gods give satisfaction to men, there will be no deification for them. The god will have to propitiate the man. Tiberius, accordingly, in whose days the Christian name made its entry into the world, having himself received intelligence from Palestine of events, please notice that, Pilate was sending surveillance reports to Caesar, which had clearly shown the truth of Christ's divinity, brought the matter before the Senate with his own decision in favour of Christ. The Senate, because it had not given the approval itself, rejected his proposal. Caesar held to his opinion, threatening wrath against all the accusers of the Christians. And then Tertullian says, consult your histories. So, Tertullian, Quintus, Septimius, Florens Tertullianus, famous early Canaanite church teacher, who gave us 509 new Latin nouns, 284 new Latin adjectives, and 161 new Latin verbs, demands the Romans check their own archived histories about the Messiah, Yeshua, and the events surrounding his life and crucifixion, because at that time they still existed as official records. So here is Tiberius Caesar, not doubting the existence of Yeshua, but knowing all about him. And if he was that much of a bad, can we say this in an Australianism? If he was that much of a bad bugger, you know, we have freedom of speech in Australia. I thank God we do. Not like the poor Americans who supposedly have freedom of speech. Here is Tiberius Caesar recognizing what the rabbis today won't and the Christians have no idea about. He wanted to make Yeshua, who could perform miracles like raising people from the dead, turning water into wine, whatever. He said, this bloke, he's got to become a god. We've got to deify him. And Tertullian says, consult your own histories. Okay. Following on the heels of the attack on the temple, Yeshua is visited at night by the most prominent, high-ranking Sanhedrin member, Nachdamon ben Gurion. He was the extremely wealthy older brother of Josephus, who admits to the Lord Yeshua that the religious and political body under Roman governance recognized. Now, please notice this. Turn over, have a look at John chapter 3 and verse 2. John chapter 3 and verse 2. They recognize it, he recognizes that from God you have come as the teacher. Now, if your version does not have the teacher, write it in there, because that's the Greek. That from God you have come as the teacher, for no man can do these miracles you perform unless God is with him. That's John chapter 3 and verse 2. But if you read right through it, read through this visit, you will find that both Nakdaimon and Yeshua call each other the teacher. So he is the top Sanhedrin priest, the top man, the top man. Yeshua proceeds to open this rabbinic scholar's mind to a heightened awareness of the purposes and intentions of God for humankind, and Yeshua pours scorn on the remarkably skeletal level of uninspired and yet so-called authoritative temple teachings. Yeshua says in verse 10, "You hold the office of the teacher in Israel, and you don't know these things? Yes, indeed, I am telling you that what we speak about, we know." Nothing I would hate more than someone who's a Christian who can't answer somebody else who inquires about our faith. Because we of all people should know what we believe in. We should know why we believe what we do. He says, "I am telling you what we speak about, we know, and we give evidence of, we have seen. But you people," now this is, I love the way John's written this, "but you people don't accept our evidence. If you people don't believe me when I tell you about the things of the world, how will you believe me when I tell you about the things of heaven?" I was listening to a lady the other day, and she was telling me about a friend of theirs, a Christian as well, but could not accept the truth of the reality of that situation in which they found themselves, because people don't want to know the reality, the truth of a matter. They want to believe in nonsense, and it's so sad. How so sad. And we're not the only ones. We've had it all the time. We've got people that ask, and we answer them, and they go, "Oh, I didn't want to hear that. I wanted to hear something else." So, John reveals, through the words of Yeshua and the plain admissions of Nakdaimon, the outright biblical ignorance of the ruling body of priests in the Sanhedrin. And if Yeshua castigated the top ruler of the Sanhedrin, what were the rest of the members like when it came to a proper understanding and grasp of their own scriptures? Mm-hmm. You know? Now, but having said that, I want to be very clear about the temple in Jerusalem. It was the temple of God. Yeshua called it my Father's house. Absolutely. And there is a spiritual temple in the heavens, which itself is a reflection of a cosmic temple that is outlined within the sphere of our present physical universe. The Kabbalah tells us that. And there was in Jerusalem a temple based upon the pattern of the heavenly spirit temple. And in all the Roman Empire, there was no edifice like that of the Jerusalem temple. It was made of the finest marble and is as tall as a 10-story modern building today. It boggles the mind when you realize the site, that the height of it. Every one of its gates were covered in pure gold. Its decorations were of the most exquisite kind, and Josephus tells us in his Wars, "The sanctuary had everything that could amaze either mind or eyes. Overlaid all around with stout plates of gold, in the first rays of the sun it reflected so fierce a blaze of fire that those who endeavoured to look at it were forced to turn away as if they had been looking straight at the sun. To strangers as they approached, it seemed in the distance like a mountain covered with snow. For any part not covered with gold was dazzling white." I wish the people who had these structures of the temple in Jerusalem and what the next temple is going to be like, I wish they could just read Josephus and believe what he wrote. It was an awesome edifice. Jerusalem under Herod had become the pearl of Roman civilization, the showplace of modern architecture. Martin Goodman tells us that in Rome and Jerusalem, the clash of ancient civilizations. He waxes eloquently on the beauty of the area, the beauty of Jerusalem, the beauty of the temple. It wasn't, as I've been saying for years, it wasn't like Hollywood depicts it, or television depicts it. Dark huts with dirt floors. It wasn't like that. The streets were marble. We've got no idea of the beauty of Jerusalem in the Second Temple period. It was the jewel of the Roman Empire. The glory of the Roman Empire was not in Rome, it was in Jerusalem. All things in Jerusalem. Josephus admits, of all the cities under Roman rule, Jerusalem reached the highest summit of prosperity. Titus, the destroyer of Jerusalem, who later became emperor of Rome, stated that the land of Herod, quote, had become much richer than Rome itself. And yet the temple, spiritually, had degenerated into a religio-political base of a highly corrupt Sadducean priesthood in the paid employ of Rome. And if you want to know what John, who wrote the Gospel of John, had to really say about the Jewish Sanhedrin and the power of Rome, just turn to the Apocalypse and look at Revelation chapter 13, where the land beast is the Sanhedrin and the political religio government of Judea, and the sea beast, the beast out of the ocean, was Rome. If you look at that, you will find that this corrupt sexual relationship that they were engaged in at that time, the late Second Temple period, was to the horror of the rabbis, the period called Yeribot HaDorot, the decline of the generations. And in fact, Second Temple, according to the rabbis, the Second Temple was destroyed by the Romans, quote, because the rulers of the Jews love money. What's changed? And each one hates his neighbour. Yeah, absolutely. So Jewish sages cite many other reasons, some plausible, others not so much, for the destruction of the Jewish state. But the land beast was utterly corrupt, Revelation 13, and you can find hints of that corruption in the Talmud. All right. Why did Yeshua curse the fig tree? It didn't produce fruit. Even though gospel writers tell us it didn't produce fruit, but it was not the season for fruit. So here you've got a very nasty saviour of the world who apparently curses this tree because it doesn't. He's hungry and there's nothing on it, even though it was a long time for the fruit. The idiocy of that idea makes me wonder about
people. Really scratching it,
though.
Huh? It's really scratching.
It's unbelievable. Look, the fact is, it was the Hellenist Herodian Sanhedrin Roman alliance, excuse me, which brought about the frightening curse from the lips of Yeshua, when he pronounced negative judgment on the fig tree. The episode is not found in Luke, it is not found in John, it is found in Matthew and it is found in Mark. I've mentioned them already and the discrepancies therein. But it's my view that this important incident should be considered in the light of John's attempt to dislocate the Judaisms of the Second Temple period from the mission of Yeshua to be proclaimed the Logos in human form, Messiah, Lord and Saviour. Recall the impertinent dismissal of the Lord Yeshua by the rulers of the Sanhedrin and the temple, who, as a result of the first demonstrable sign, that is, turning water into wine, react by wanting to murder their king. That's what it says. Take him out and stone him. Yeshua knew full well that the fig tree only bears figs in its season. It won't bear it until the Passover season. So he's not at all interested in judging a fig tree except as being symbolic of the political, religious, Jewish state. and his curse on the fig tree is indicative of his prophetic office. Remember, prophets of God in ancient Israel and Judea, they had to act out what it was that God was going to bring about on the nation. They had to act it out. Ezekiel had the lie on his side for so long, and then turn on his other side for so long. And Jeremiah had to do things, and Isaiah had to strip himself off naked, get sexually excited, and walk around like that in front of all Israel. Terrible! But God demanded it. You know, I mean, Hollywood does it all the time. People don't think twice. But here are prophets of God. Remember, what's his name? Saul, Israel's first king. He's acting like a weirdo, an idiot. And what do they say? Is he also among the prophets of God? Because he was demonstrably weird in the way he was acting. And in fact, they thought he had come under the direct influence of the College of the Prophets, and it's referred like that in 1 Samuel 10:6 and 10-12, and chapter 19 of 1 Samuel, verses 18 to 24. And Yeshua was no different when he was acting out his prophetic mission. So he curses the fig tree, which is the symbol of Israel. And this is known and recognized by all scholars of the biblical revelation. Now, it's intriguing to my mind that the Christians, the Messianists of Josephus, remember, they're the Christians. If you're reading Josephus and you see Messianists, they're the Christians. They anticipated the destruction of the Judean state together with Roman imperialism precisely 40 years from the date of Yeshua's crucifixion. Now, again, I found it very interesting how Amos's Parsha dovetailed today with this lecture, the 40 years. Because, according to them, the sons of light would come into a final conflict with the sons of darkness, initiating the rapid return of the Messiah from the heavens. And an early Zealot document has been incorporated into 2nd Baruch, the Syriac Apocalypse of Baruch. And if you look at chapter 30 and verse 1, it says this: "It will come to pass after these things, when the time of the advent of the Messiah is fulfilled, and he will return in glory." And this is what I find so interesting about it being a Zealot document. He will return in glory. The only Messiah that was going to return was one who was crucified, dead, resurrected, went to heaven, and said he's coming back. So they believed in Yeshua. "He will return in glory, then all who have fallen asleep in him will rise again. It will come to pass at that time that the treasuries will be opened, in which is preserved the number of the souls of the righteous. They will come forth, and a multitude of souls will be seen together in one assemblage of one thought." You see, the Zealots understood thought. They understood the mind of God. They understood the speaking of a word to bring about a fulfillment of an event. Why? Because their Saviour, their Lord, their Redeemer, and their King, Yeshua, the Nazarene King of the Jews, the Zealot King, was able to show them what to do, under what circumstance. Did they obey him? No, they didn't. Did the Christians? No, they didn't. Do we? No. We need to, in every event, we need to recognize that it all exists in one thought. And in that thought, because that's all that our reality is, it consists of our thought, our thinking process, that's our reality. We can change our reality by changing our thoughts. And he says, "A multitude of souls will be seen together in one assemblage, in one thought. And the first will rejoice and the last will not be grieved." You know, the last will be first, the first will be last, and all of that. Absolutely. Christ died in 30 CE. Not 31, not 33, not 29, not 35. But in 30 CE. And 40 years from that time would bring us to 70 CE. One only has to consider looking through the book of Hebrews, the letter to the Hebrews, and look at chapter 3. Chapter 3 of Hebrews. And you will find the view of the early Christians, the Messianists, that Yeshua was coming back in 40 years' time. That's how they saw it. And so the Zealots went to war against Rome at that time. I love Hebrews, I can never find it. Hebrews chapter 3. And the writer of the letter to the Hebrews, rather intriguingly, quotes from Psalm 95. Psalm 95. I want you to have a look at verse 7. As the Holy Spirit tells us, today if you hear his voice, harden not your hearts. Again, working right in with the parsha of Amos today. Harden not your hearts, as in the day of provocation, in the day of temptation in the wilderness, when your fathers tempted me, proved me, saw my works 40 years. Now, this writer has written about a 40-year period for a reason. Wherefore I was grieved with that generation. So this is a 40-year generation. The writer of the letter to the Hebrews is intrigued by this. And so am I. Because if Yeshua died in 30 CE, 40 would take us to 70 CE and the return of the Messiah, supposedly. And how long did the Zealots wait before they rose up in rebellion? 65-year period, which would take them right to the time of 66 CE, when they launched against Rome. Fascinating stuff. And here the 40 years is most important to this writer. And he swore in my wrath, verse 11, they shall not enter my rest. Take heed, brothers, lest there be in any of you an evil heart, that is an uncircumcised heart, of unbelief in departing from the living God. But exhort one another today, while it is called today, while it is called now. So he's saying this 40 years is going to be the last 40 years on planet Earth. He understood the end of the world is coming in the year 70 CE. Any wonder the zealots rose up saying, yes, now, take the sword. Yeshua said, if you've got a sword, well, they've got two. And he said, it's enough. It all ties in beautifully, but you know what? Millions perished. Millions perished. Yet, verse 14, we are made partakers of Christ if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast to the end. While it is said, today if you will hear his voice, don't harden your hearts. Verse 16, for some when they had heard did provoke, and not all that came out of Egypt by Moses. Verse 17, but with whom was he grieved 40 years? Was it not with them that had sinned, whose carcasses fell in the wilderness? And to whom sware he that they should not enter into his rest, but to them that believed not? We can see, therefore, that they could not enter in because of their unbelief. So in 66, when the zealots all rose up, Yeshua had also said, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, get out and head for the hills. And they did. But that 40 years would take them to 70 CE. And we look at that and we go, but they rose up in at 66 CE. How on earth would that be 70? Would that be 40 years from 30 CE? Well, it's very interesting. You add 66. You add 3.5 years to that, which John said was going to happen. And you get to the period 70, 69 AD, CE. 40 long years I was grieved with this generation. It's rather interesting that the writer contrasts the existing corruption of the temple with the authentic temple, the spirit-imbued Nazarene messianic movement. Qumran predated the messianists by referring to their own order as the collective authentic temple of God in the New Jerusalem. And James the Just was Qumran's alternative high priest of Jerusalem, and the chief administrator of that which evolved into what we know today as the church. Only the high priest could legitimately enter the Holy of Holies once a year on Yom Kippur. And that holy day of the Jewish calendar, two identical goats were selected and brought before the high priest, and around one of the horns was placed a red thread, a crimson thread. For 40 long years, because in the past that thread used to change to white if God was pleased with the people, or it would remain crimson if he was in judgment of them. For all that time, 40 years from the time of the crucifixion of Yeshua, that red thread remained scarlet. It never once turned white. The idea that the high priest had a great big rope around him, around his ankle and around his waist, You will not find that in history. You will not find it in the Talmud. You will not find it anywhere. It's a medieval legend. And there's no proof that he ever had that. And that is quite true. But the fact of the matter is that for 40 years, the scarlet remained scarlet and never turned white. Yeshua died in 30 CE, and in 70 CE, the Jewish state was destroyed, Jerusalem was destroyed, and millions perished. All right. Finally, I want you to come over and look at the very final demoting action that John gives to Judaism in the Second Temple period, and we'll finish with this. I want you to turn with me over to John chapter 4, where he talks about a Samaritan, a pagan Samaritan woman. Now, I've been showing you for weeks now that Yeshua's attack on the temple was to cleanse it or purify it of its house leprosy. I will call it that because that's exactly what had happened to it. It had become a place full of covetousness, and we know that covetousness is idolatry. And John sets the stage by reducing our confidence, or any Christian's confidence, in the Sinai covenant and in Judaism of the time. He starts it in John 1:17, where he threatens the Sinai covenant by stating the Torah was given by Moses, grace and truth came by Yeshua the Messiah. And John thus imparts to his priestly colleagues the way of contrast between Moses and between Yeshua, who was the Logos, who became flesh and dwelt among us. Secondly, he projects a very, very sad scenario of the teacher of righteousness, John the Baptizer, as not being the Messiah, as his believers, as his followers thought he was, but that the one he baptized was to be the Messiah. And in fact, his original messianic movement had to decrease while Yeshua's increased. And in fact, John, the gospel writer, says to his priestly colleagues that John the Baptizer stated in verse 30 of John 3, I must decrease, Yeshua must increase. And thus he diminishes the role of John the Baptist as the Messiah, which he wasn't, nor did he claim to be. His disciples are still around in Syria and Iraq, but many of them have been killed by ISIS, which is a very, very tragic situation. Thirdly, John shows how insipid the stone symbols of ceremonial and ritual water cleansing requirements really are, and he has Yeshua turn their contents into the symbol of his pure blood, which will give life not just to the Jewish people, but to the whole world. And then fourthly, he portrays the temple of God as an unholy place, filled with the representatives of idolatry in the form of covetousness. Yeshua cleanses it because it is in dire need of purification and sanctification. Fifth, John has the religious authorities asking for a sign to justify his temporary seizure of the temple. They are so blind as to not recognize the true temple is standing in their presence. By this means, John shows his readers how unspiritual their priesthood is in actual fact. Carnal religious people can only see the world through carnal religious eyes. It's impossible to see it otherwise. But sixth, John introduces us in the shadow of a night visit to an ignorant teacher known as Nicodemus, Nakdamon Ben-Gurion, the top brass of the Sanhedrin. He is, as Yeshua refers to him, the teacher of Israel. Yet this generous man is unenlightened and unknowledgeable. And seventh, John gives us a glimpse, albeit fragile, of a conversation Yeshua has with an important Samaritan woman at Jacob's well. And this hybrid race of Samaritans were expecting a Messiah themselves, and they were acting out a spurious form of Judaism on Mount Gerizim. And I've been derogatory toward this woman in many of my lectures because of her connection to Simon the Magus and the rise of a subversion of Christianity. Because the Samaritans were pretend Jews, which is a matter of history, and you will even find it's a matter of the biblical revelation, but I've gone into that before and I won't talk about it now. They were liars, they claim to be Jews and are not, but do lie, says John. Now, note the transformation in the mind of a pagan, unclean, Gentile, Samaritan woman. And I'm going to finish on this conversation that Yeshua has with this woman. But there is a progression as far as her spiritual development is concerned. In John 4, verse 7, look at John 4, verse 7. The woman comes to the well. Messiah invades her mental space. Note the word give. He says, give me to drink. He is the one who initiates the conversation. He says, give. He didn't start his conversation with a rebuke, which the Jews would have done to the Samaritans. He says, give me a drink.
Please.
Well, even please. It doesn't say that in Greek. It doesn't give me a drink. So he gives a request. Look at verse 9. Look at verse 9. John 4 and verse 9. I find this very interesting. Then says the woman of Samaria to him, how is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink of me, who am a woman of Samaria? For the Jews had no dealings with the Samaritans. So she refers to him as a Jew. Right? Clearly it's there. Then look at verse 11. She goes from calling him a Jew to calling him a man. The woman says to him, verse 9. The woman says to him, how is it you being a Jew? That's right. And then down here to verse 11. The woman says to him, sir, you have nothing to draw with and the well is deep. From whence have you that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank of himself, his children and his cattle? The actual Greek refers to man and then sir. Now this is rather intriguing because she goes from Jew to man to sir. Now, pretty soon, if you look at verse 15, you'll find the word sir again used. The woman says to him, sir. And then, when you go down to verse 19, what does she call him? I perceive that you are a prophet. So she goes from Jew to man to sir to prophet. And Yeshua then takes an advantage of this woman getting to that point, and he says something rather profound. Believe me, woman, the time is coming when you will not go to this mountain nor yet to Jerusalem to worship the Father. So here John, in recounting this, demotes Mount Gerizim and also Jerusalem. He denotes it, demotes it. He says, you worship, you cannot tell what. We worship knowing what it is we worship. Salvation, after all, is to come from the Jews. But the time is coming. No, it's already come. When true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. Such men as these, the Father claims for his worshippers. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. So Jerusalem is demoted. It's no longer number one big place to go to. She responds, I know the Messiah must come, and when he does, he will inform us of everything. So she has not yet acknowledged Yeshua as the Messiah, but she will in a minute, because so far he is a Jew, a man, an individual worthy of respect, a prophet, and she's well on the way to acknowledging his divinity. And Yeshua helps her along. He says, I who speak with you am the Messiah. Now he hasn't turned around and said this for years to the Jewish rabbinic scholars, but he turns around to a pagan, unclean Gentile and tells her who he is. The issue of worship is now settled once and for all. It is not Gerizim where men shall worship God, nor is it Jerusalem. It is the person of Mashiach, Yeshua alone. And the surprised woman is so shocked, she runs away, forgets a bucket. Why? Because she doesn't even say farewell. She races away to share Yeshua with her friends and with her associates. So the spirit of evangelism has hit her hard. and she cries aloud with joy. And what does she say? Come. She says, come, verse 29, and have sight of a man who has told me the story of my life. Can this be the Messiah? So the first evangelist in Samaria urges her colleagues to come and see Yeshua for themselves, to make up their own minds, to assess by their own experiential knowledge if he is or is not the promised Messiah. So the men of the village come to investigate for themselves at the woman's invitation. Now remember, these are Samaritans, the most despised and maligned race of people on the face of the earth as far as the Jews were concerned, and the Samaritans thought exactly the same about the Jews. But the Samaritan woman encourages her fellow Samaritans to shake off their prejudices. That's the point that jumped out at me when I read this again. I just thought, oh, she's telling them to get over it. Get over yourselves. Come and see. This Jew is the Messiah. So now, in this progressive way, the Apostle John has the Samaritans realizing Yeshua is more than a despised Jew, more than a mere mortal, more worthy of respect than they realized, more than a prophet, and in reality the Messiah. But then in verse 42, he's identified as the Savior of the world. So here is this progression of self-revelation of Yeshua to a despised Samaritan woman, and John the Apostle is rubbing it into his priestly colleagues, saying a pagan, unclean, Gentile, Samaritan woman has got the truth about Yeshua, and you people remain in ignorance and in darkness and in hatred. It's astonishing. So John has demoted in this first sign, the Sinai covenant. He has disparaged the temple priesthood. He has implied that the Sanhedrin is insipid, unholy, unspiritual, and ignorant. And he now calls the festivals of Israel the Jews' feasts. In John 2, verse 13, John 5, verse 1, John 6, verse 4, John 7, verse 2, John 10, verse 22, John 11, verse 55. These are all the Jews' feasts. Yet all of this is attractive to carnal, competitive Jewish religious authorities who only want to kill Yeshua. And it's food for thought. Question. Well, Matthew mentions the Jews by the term the Jews on five occasions. In Mark's Gospel, they're called the Jews six times. In Luke, the Jews are called that five times. In John, they are called that 69 times. 69 times. Modern Sinai-bound legalistic messianics do not like these odds stacked against them. Which is probably why the representative that came today didn't stay, because he couldn't have heard it. The question is there anything intrinsically wrong in a covenant? Of course not. Is there anything awry in the work of a priesthood? No. Or in possessing a temple as a sacred space? No. Or in activating a governing body over synagogues, congregations and assemblies so that all may be done in order and doctrinal and administrative confusion diminished. Government always comes from God. So what about the keeping of festivals and holy days, kept in their proper perspective and observing them as a religious tradition which has intrinsic value, can be an uplifting and worthwhile spiritual experience? But John's general condemnation of the decayed and rebellious Second Temple period is John's summation of the Jewish priesthood. This is John's summing up of the Sanhedrin, which the Apocalypse states is in a lascivious sensual relationship with the Roman beast. And in the next few years, the state of Israel is going to once again repeat itself by going into a relationship with the beast system, which will destroy them. The first sign of John has to do with conversion, transmutation, metamorphosis, leading to transformational cleansing into a new order of creation with creative intent. And we can draw from this sign an appropriation of the principle concerning the outworking of this miraculous event in the pursuit of the character of the Christian life, obviously. It is small wonder that 1 Corinthians 1:23, Paul writes, "We preach the Messiah crucified, to the Jews a scandal." When you have the historic Yeshua elevated back into his rightful place in history, when you see the wonder worker, as the Slavonic text of Josephus refers to him, working miracles that brought the entire Roman power against him, when you see Tiberius Caesar wanting to make him a god, when you see him linked with zealots because he was their zealot king, small wonder Paul says the Messiah crucified is a scandal. He says to the Gentiles it's actually absurd. And that's how the world still today views Yeshua. He is both a scandal and an absurdity. And those who believe in Yeshua are looked upon as absurd as well. That we would worship a crucified Jew that died 2,000 long years ago. You see, everybody knew what had transpired back there in Jerusalem in 30 CE, which is why Paul called it a scandal and an absurdity. So we're now leaving the first sign, which John has shared with his priestly colleagues and the Johannine Circle of Faith. And we must admit that if there is any apt description of the Second Temple period as viewed by John the Apostle as appropriate, it is the following condemnation in one single word: loveless. In closing this lecture and proceeding to the second sign, I want to make a statement that is a truism. God prefers a loving sinner to a loveless saint. And as we continue in our sweep of this gospel in this current series of lectures, may we all be keen to benefit from a deeper, more balanced view of the Gospel of John. Are there any questions on any of that very heavy, voluminous lecture, which I promise never ever to repeat again? No?